You're recording.
All right, perfect. So I'm going to call this November 15, 2022 Planning Commission meeting to order at 6:36 p.m. Would everybody please rise for the Pledge of Allegiance?
Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. We'll proceed with roll call here. If you could signify by saying present when I call your name. Pat Huggins,
here.
Eric Johnson, here. Daniel Freiberger.
Present.
Joe Fatizzi is excused on a temporary absence. Silas Maddox.
Present.
Joe Frenette.
Present.
And Stacy Penno is absent. Quorum is present. Now the chair will entertain a motion to accept the consent agenda. Are there any comments or edits that need to be made to the minutes that were provided in the packet? Hearing none, I will entertain a motion to approve the minutes.
I so move.
I'll second.
It's been moved by Commissioner Freiberger and seconded by Commissioner Huggins. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, motion carries. General public comment. This is where the public has an opportunity to speak to the Planning Commission regarding issues that they may want to have heard or addressed with the Planning Commission, with the exception of being those items that are listed under the public hearing. So in this case tonight, it would be addressing the homeless encampment issue. So any issues besides that, as that will be heard momentarily after. You have an opportunity now to speak for 3 minutes. Is there anybody in the audience that wishes to make a public comment? Seeing none from the audience present, and being that there is no general public on Zoom, we'll move on to the public hearing. Possible amendments to create a new chapter in Title 17, City of William Municipal Code, to address state requirements for homeless encampments operated by religious organizations. Director Coleman, would you lead us into this, please?
All right, thank you. So we'll be having a public hearing shortly and opening up for the public to speak. But first, we're going to have a presentation from our city attorney, a member of our Tara, with our city attorney's office, that's going to give a background to this. And then if there's any further questions that you would like staff to address, we can get to that after the public hearing part. So we'll do the presentation and then open up the public hearing for the public to speak. After public is done speaking, then we'll close the public hearing and begin discussion, and you'll have the opportunity to ask any further questions at that time. So with that, I'll just turn it over to our attorney's office now. So Tara, could you please introduce yourself for everybody? We don't have the option to see you here, unfortunately. So thank you.
That's okay. Tara Kaler from Thompson Gildner. I'm a senior associate. I am speaking on behalf of the city tonight. The issue here is that the city does not have any regulations surrounding homeless encampments at religious organizations. The Washington Constitution has expansive protections for religion and religious organizations vis-a-vis zoning. Organizations have had a long-standing tradition of hosting the homeless in terms of utilizing the protections for the religious rights under the Washington Constitution in hosting the homeless on their property. In 2009, the Washington Supreme Court held that the restrictions must be narrow for achieving a compelling goal. And again, the Washington Constitution allows for these the expansive religious protections, however, does recognize that peace and safety must be regulated as well. So in keeping with the Washington Constitution balancing the protections for religion and balancing the religious organization's desire to host homeless populations, the motion is on the table currently to add Chapter 17, which would impose regulations around peace and safety in keeping with the 2009 Washington Supreme Court case, and then making amendments to Chapter 2.90 to the Cedar Woolley Municipal Code in order to align Chapter 17 with Chapter 2.90. If these regulations were not in place, the religious organizations would be not constrained by anything existing in the city code as it is right now. That is to say, homeless encampments would not have any zoning, peace or safety regulations surrounding how they are implemented at religious organizations' property. The proposal here is modeled after several other cities who have enacted ordinances for the same purpose. This is also in compliance with statute in Washington. So it's not without some precedent here. There are other regulations in other cities that are very similar. The permit that is anticipated in Chapter 17 is related to temporary homeless encampments. There is no permit required for safe parking. That is just generally because the administrative burden regarding safe parking might outweigh the benefits of imposing a permit. So the motion stands then for these amendments to Title 17 and Chapter 2.9 to address the permitting for temporary homeless encampments.
Thank you, Tara. I will now be opening up the public hearing at 6:44 p.m. And did we have anybody actually sign up to speak?
Yes.
Okay.
Phil Murray.
Phil Murray, if you want to come to the podium here and state your name and address for the record.
Philip Murray, 101 West Woodworth, Cedar Woolley. I'm wondering who's here representing the homeless when you're speaking about this stuff. I don't see anybody representing them. And it needs to be brought up and represented by somebody, even the church people, somebody. And how many categories of homeless are there? You have drug people on drugs. You have just plain homeless, nowhere to go, can't work, mental issues. You have people in travel trailers, motorhomes. There's so many different categories of it. You can't just ball it up into a ball and say, this is a homeless situation. And you're going to end up with a lot more homeless people. Because I know a lot of people that are switching from owning homes to being able to be out of here whenever they want. And it's going to change a lot. And just wanted you to be aware of that people need to be here to speak about it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else that has signed up? Any other members of the general public present that would like to speak on this issue? Seeing none in the in-person audience, and being that there is still no one on Zoom, I'm going to go ahead and I will close the public hearing at 6:46 p.m. So at this time, Planning Commission is invited to discuss any thoughts that they may have for providing any questions to council that's present. And if there's anybody that would like to initiate that, feel free to speak up.
I'll start. I just have a sort of a general question about this. All these homeless encampments are referred to repeatedly as temporary, but I actually didn't see any sort of time limit on them in the ordinance. And I did see in one place where it was said that they could only apply for a permit every 12 months, but I might just be missing it. But
it's way at the bottom.
It's all the way at the bottom.
180 days, I think it's it.
Okay, that was my question.
Yes, there's a 180 day limit to any temporary encampment at any religious facility, and then there's a they can't apply again until the next year.
Okay, so we're on that's number 16.
Is that accurate, Tara?
Yes. So if you look to, I'm sorry, I don't have page.
I found it. It's number 16 under 17110030.
Yes, on page 10. And that is also in compliance with the statute that governs kind of the contours of what a city can impose.
Tara, do you happen to know off the top of your head what that 2009 case was?
It is the City of Woodinville versus North Shore United Church of Christ.
No, you said North Shore United Church of Christ?
That's correct.
Thank you. Is there anybody else? Commissioner Huggins, do you have any questions or comments?
No comments this moment.
Commissioner Freiberger?
Well, I assume requiring SEPA is within the legal guidelines as well. 30 days for a minimum timeline seemed kind of short to complete that. But
which section are you referring to? Tara, are you familiar with the 30-day comment, the requirement to that Commissioner Freiberger was speaking of?
Are you referring to page 7.E? The application must be filed at least 30 days before the date on which the temporary homeless encampment is proposed to move on to the proposed location.
That's correct. Thank you.
So that does pose a, you know, a processing issue. You know, what Commissioner Freiberger is speaking of is if we run SEPA, which we understand that we do, it would be difficult for us to, for the city to approve a permit in 30 days. So does that statute imply that the city only has 30 days to approve a permit?
I don't read it that way. I suppose it could be read that way, but I read that to mean that that is a ceiling in terms of the amount of time that the religious organization must file their application.
Okay.
But not a requirement on the city's part to issue that permit within 30 days of the filing?
Correct.
May I recommend that we put a little disclaimer at the end of that sentence saying something to the effect of this clause does not require the city to approve a permit within 30 days?
Yes.
Good catch on that.
And then just kind of a clarification question. When it mentions hardship and that the director can make some judgment calls on that, is SEPA one of those things that could be waived?
Tara's got a great answer to this one.
So, no, it cannot. And I'm just trying to, scroll back through my notes here. The Washington legislature considered making an exemption for SEPA for temporary homeless permits in 2019. But that effort to exempt SEPA from this particular type of process was not successful, which to me would indicate that SEPA would then, yes, apply. And in other situations in other cities, the city has undertaken a SEPA process in order to have that that environmental review. So yes, I would say that SEPA does apply. There are no exemptions in the SEPA statutes to indicate that there would be an exception. Nothing wiggly that we could even kind of argue that would apply in this situation.
Thank you. And is there also precedent for the one acre, the land, minimum land size requirement?
Yes, I believe that's in the statute as well.
Okay. That's all I had.
Commissioner Furnett, do you have any questions or comments?
A couple. Has there been any religious organizations that have requested a temporary encampment?
I'm a little gray on the issue. I believe yes. And they approached the city and wanted to know what the rules were, and I believe the response was, well, we better make some rules for you then, for you to be able, because they were interested to know what the rules were. And so the city has been in contact with them and just about this proposed regulation.
Okay. Well, following what Philip said, I don't see anyone here from that organization commenting. It'd be nice. I don't see anybody. A lot of this, the rules I was happy to see are pretty stringent. And a lot of it has to do with enforcement. And I don't see any law enforcement here commenting either, because this could be, could be a difficult task to make sure everyone's following these rules. There's a lot of rules. And someone's got to pay attention to it.
So this particular public hearing was advertised extra early. It was advertised on our website, on the Planning Commission page, agenda pages, all agendas and hearings are. We also put it on the city's news page, the main news feed, and advertised it on our Facebook page, which we've been monitoring to see if there's been any contact, questions or anything. So, of course, it's been published in the newspaper, and there's no place to post on site because this is a legislative change, and there's not like a specific place where we would post a notice. But So it has done, we have done extra public notifications on this. I'm unsure if anybody made any direct comments, had any direct contact with any potential applicants. I'm not aware of those applicants, so I did not do so, but it was widely advertised.
Well, I understand why there's a need for this. It's kind of like the ADU things too. It's going to happen sooner or later because it's forced on us. So we came up with the rules preemptive. And I can understand this is kind of the same situation, that this will happen regardless, but we better have some rules. So that's the good part. It'd just be nice if we got feedback from people that want to utilize it. And will it be enforced?
It will be enforced, and the police department has been briefed on this issue, at least the leadership level. It's not an official rule yet, so it's not being taught to people that are going to be enforcing it. But it has been looked at by the city departments. And fire is also involved too. And it's a lot of fire safety happens at any sort of congregate living, whether you've got multiple people living in a place, whether it be apartment building or an assembly building, wherever people congregate, fire is a major player. And so they have also reviewed this. There's, make no mistake, we're very aware of the impacts of the homeless encampment on city services. And so that is primarily the driver of an ordinance like this, is to make sure that our city services are prepared and able to accommodate appropriately.
That's all.
Thank you.
I did have two more comments about safe parking.
Yeah, absolutely.
I saw at the end it has a kind of disclaimer in there for corrections for Scrivener errors and such, but page 12 and page 13, the safe parking seems to be numerically, how it's organized is very confusing. So, I'm not sure if that's an error or I'm just
10070.
That's correct.
So you get A, B,
and then 1, 2 under B, and then a small a under 2. Maybe that's correct. And then 3, 4, 5 through 8, and then C, 1, 2, 3, and then A, B, C. Okay, maybe that's.
That looks all right.
Okay.
Yeah, because you've got A and B are your bigger ones, and then you go a subset of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8,
okay.
And then you return back to C, which is the major set,
okay.
And then again down to the 1, 2, 3, and then down again to A, B, C. So yeah, that looks accurate. When a lot of times you'll see like the A, B, C being the widest indent, and then under C, for example, if there's 1, 2, 3, it's indented, and then so it helps you understand that it's. We did not format it that way. I apologize if there was confusion.
Okay, thank you. Just wanted to clarify that the mailing for the safe parking, since it doesn't require a permit, is the responsibility of the applicant, the host, and then they just provide an affidavit of mailing to the city, whereas during for the homeless encampment, it's the city who sends out the mailing because of doing SEPA.
So Tara, correct me if I'm wrong, since there's no permitting process for the safe parking, there's no requirement for notification and there's no requirement for SEPA.
That's correct for the safe parking. There is the obligation for the the host to notify the property owners. And there's a public meeting that's required, but those are the obligation of the host and not the city.
Okay. So the city does for homeless encampments because it's through SEPA, but since parking is not a permit, that is the responsibility of the host. Okay. Thank you.
Any other comments or questions? So I have to say I am of a little bit of two minds on this whole thing. One, you know, I do recognize, as Commissioner Frenette pointed out, that we are getting ahead of the game when it comes to the state, which I think is always wise to try to put our stamp on things before the state can dictate to us. And, you know, I also think that this is a real issue. You know, there is a lot of homeless. I think there's a lot more homeless in our area than we probably would like to recognize. And, you know, it'd be nice to make sure that it's not necessarily just the Wild West when it comes to encampments, and that there is some regulation and some structure to it. And I credit the authors. I don't know if it was your office, Tara, or someone here at the city who drafted this, but, you know, I did think it was very well written. It is pretty stringent, provides a lot of safeguards and boundaries and sets standards, all of which I think are very much needed in a situation like this that can easily get out of hand. You know, I realize that there are only certain parameters that we can put on it. You know, I would wish and I would hope that we would be able to, although I doubt it, and you can, you know, either corroborate me or correct me. You know, I wish that we could demand that there be services provided along with the allowance to host these encampments, because I feel like that is an important aspect of this. You know, and there's multiple different services that I'm talking about, you know, whether it's, you know, being connected with opportunities for finding transitional housing to eventually get into a place of their own and get out of essentially homelessness, to mental health services in particular, which I think is probably actually the real driving force behind a lot of this, mental health services and also substance abuse services. And, you know, if we're not able to kind of make those demands or those requirements, you know, I would, and I'm sure that the city would strongly encourage that those get provided. Do you have any thoughts regarding that, Tara? I mean, I know you had made mention about it being narrowly tailored, so I'm assuming that there's only so much that we can put, and we've put a lot of parameters on this as is, but just curious as to your thoughts on that.
It's interesting the way that the statute is designed, basically to set up the kind of the structure that there are no regulations, that a religious organization may host the homeless. However, cities may enact these ordinances that have some baseline for peace and safety. When we get outside of the peace and safety, regulating kind of the how and the where, and start into the why, that's where it might get a little sketchier in terms of the impermissible versus incidental regulation, kind of things that the things that are attaching to the regulations that are imposing a burden on the religious organizations. If the religious organizations say these are not connected to peace and safety, they might have a real argument there. So there is kind of a risk of regulating too much and requiring too much. We really have to stick to peace and safety, and we're pretty safe sticking with the requirements found in the statute. There's a very strong argument that we're just kind of following what the legislature has said is reasonable for restrictions around some of these homeless encampments. So deviating from that too much, there's a risk in that. If there are city services, the correct place perhaps to tie the city service back to the permitted encampments would be in the code provisions that connect city services to people. In terms of, you know, identifying permitted homeless institutions that are run by religious organizations and requiring the city to reach out or have the, some sort of social worker connect with the people experiencing homelessness. This is a good first step in terms of adding Chapter 17 and amending 2.1. But to take it further, I think would necessarily need additional changes in other areas of the code as well.
Okay. Another question that I have is kind of two-parter is, from my reading, is it my understanding that this kind of gives a lot of latitude to the host or the sponsor for making their own regulations? I'm assuming that if they open up their property, their premises for this encampment, and they're choosing to sponsor, they're able to kind of create their own internal rules and regulations regarding this. And so, like, you know, they can't just be overrun on their property with encampment, you know, they, because I'm, you know, the premises, I'm sure, by and large, you know, like churches or mosques or tabernacles or what have you, and they're wanting to kind of control where on the property these encampments are going to be located, whether it's in the building or outside the building. And then two, so this pretty much, you know, with that premise in mind, but it does allow for like a religious organization, whatever it may be, to buy property and create an encampment just kind of unto itself, correct?
Sure, you could do that. But again, there are the time limits imposed in the proposal that would not just make a kind of a permanent homeless encampment run by a religious organization.
Mm-hmm. And then the last question that I have, which is the, in my opinion, the big elephant in the room and what makes me be of two minds about this is the enforcement of it. So I know professionally, because the law firm that I work at, we do a lot of landlord-tenant, and I realize this probably doesn't fall necessarily under the Landlord-Tenant Act. It probably would be more of an ejectment matter, but when I asked this at the work session, I didn't really get a great answer, a clear answer, and hopefully maybe there's been a little bit of research or some clarification that's come with this, but when things do get out of hand, and I guarantee you that they will on some level or another, you know, how does enforcement actually transpire? So whether it's the city recognizing that the host or sponsor isn't, you know, enforcing what they've agreed to uphold, or when a license has been revoked under, what was it, 17110.060, or when there's individual participants, residents of the encampments that are just completely unruly. You know, I know it's going to come to that at some point, and probably sooner rather than later, because I know with my clients, one of the first things I always hear is, I was trying to do a favor, but, and, you know, no good deed goes unpunished. And so, you know, while I do believe that this is necessary and, you know, I support passing this, you know, the enforcement mechanism needs to have teeth as well, or else, you know, this is not going to be a good addition to the municipal code. So what exactly, do you know what the process would be? Do you know what kind of teeth it has? I mean, is it going to be a long drawn out process? Because I know right now everything is in favor of tenants with the Landlord Tenant Act. So is there anything that you can do to, you know, squash my fears and concerns with how this is going to transpire when it does go awry?
Well, I do not exactly know the answer to that question. And I think that's a great question, because I agree that this, I mean, if there are no teeth, then this becomes meaningless, perhaps. There is the provision to have a hearing. So if the permit gets denied, I understand that's not the same situation exactly that you're describing here. Yeah, we don't really have that written into Chapter 17. However, being a Type 2 permit, there might be something that I'm not appreciating at this moment. But I'm sorry, I don't have a better answer right now.
You're referring to, so 17.110.060 does have a process for the revocation. So what would happen is, if it needs to be revoked, the planning director makes revokes the permit, and that is a de facto, according to this, Type 2 permit. So it's an administrative decision, which then can be appealed by somebody. And then the hearing examiner would then, according to section 060, the hearing examiner would then have a hearing on the revocation action. And then the hearing examiner makes their decision. That hearing examiner decision is then appealable to the Skagit County Superior Court. So is that the process that you were talking about, Tara?
Yes.
Do you know,
as far as your concerns regarding kind of the public safety aspect, I don't think there's a way to strengthen Chapter 17 without going into the criminal code too much. So I think that, you know, the public safety concerns, while they are a reality, would be better addressed by law enforcement. And it sounds like there's been contact with law enforcement leadership to apprise them of this proposal.
And your concerns are, but how does the city,
well, so enforce? So to give you an example, because this, I mean, this is going to be like splitting hairs between what is and what isn't, you know, landlord tenant is, you know, under the Landlord Tenant Act, when there is an issue that comes up, you know, between landlord and tenant. So in this case, it'd be sponsor and resident. You know, you call law enforcement, and 99.9% of the time out of 100, you know, they're going to turn around and say, well, this is actually a civil issue and it needs to be resolved. Talk to your attorney. So, you know, this is a residential situation. And so when, you know, disputes happen between tenants and sponsors, as far as, you know, how they may be misbehaving or violating whatever sort of codes that they're, codes of conduct that they're, you know, entering into, you know, that's going to be a civil matter. know, it's not always going to be criminally based. So, I mean, this is, I'd imagine this is going to end up more often than not in being a civil matter than a criminal matter.
I guess, you know, picture, does it make any difference of whether or not we have this in place or not? Because remember, temporary homeless encampment can happen at a religious institution today, whether or not we pass an ordinance. So passing this ordinance change
it, your it does. It does, because it changes the status of the situation, where one is just a, you know, at a certain point, an unauthorized guest situation, and there's a clear statute and procedure for that. I'm curious if there, being that this is a different status that these residents will have, they're not just simply guests, they're now a resident of an actual recognized encampment. You know, I mean, like I said, I'm going to support this regardless. I just want to make sure that there's like some sort of teeth and enforcement mechanism to it. And I'm not hearing a whole lot of that. I mean, I realize that the permit can be revoked and that there's a adjudicating process with a public hearing with that. And that's great. But, you know, I know that on an individual resident basis, there's going to be issues that are going to crop up. And how do you go about dealing with those?
So it seems to me that what you're describing is almost like a mechanism for resolving disputes between the participants in the encampment, or between the host and the person experiencing homelessness?
For the most part, yes. Like, because they're being held to a certain standard. You know, there's certain, in order for an encampment to exist in this, under this code, you know, there's certain things that have to be adhered to. And, you know, whether that's the sponsor not properly enforcing, or just a dispute between the sponsor and the resident of the encampment, you know, there's going to have to be some sort of delineated process.
What role would you see the city having in that process in terms of the permit?
Well, if you know, things aren't properly being enforced, you know, they're an established type of residency under the city's, you know, designation. So the city is naturally going to have a role to play in the enforcement of these encampments to a degree. And I don't know whether or not, you know, I mean, like we've said, you know, there will be enforcement from the city with these encampments. So, you know, I mean, it's a kind of a two element kind of enforcement that I'm calling into question here. I mean, there is whether or not the sponsor is properly hosting versus whether a resident is properly residing there. I mean, because there's two different, I guess, for lack of a better term, ejectment matters that could crop up there, whether it's the permit being revoked. I mean, okay, so it's revoked, then how does that get enforced? Because I know that superior courts are very slow and cautious to evict anybody from any sort of dwelling situation.
I would imagine that relationship and interaction would be between the religious organization and the participants in the encampment, rather than between the city and the encampment participants, because really the relationship here would be between the city and the religious organization as the permittee.
Okay.
But I agree that there could be teeth, right? There's nothing in the statute prohibiting a penalty for non-compliance.
That's what I was going to ask. Would it be possible to enforce fines, code enforcement, as is done with other types of permits?
And forgive me for not knowing this, but as a type 2 permit, I imagine there are enforcement mechanisms for that type of permit, correct?
Violations of Chapter 17 go to the code enforcement chapter, which is Chapter 18. It is not specified in this ordinance whether it goes to the criminal code or if it goes to the code enforcement code for compliance with code enforcement.
Okay, so we could make that more clear.
A very quick question for you. You had made mention earlier about other municipalities have enacted similar codes, and you were kind of piggybacking off of them. What do you know what municipalities those were?
Mount Vernon has a pretty identical looking code. Vancouver has a safe parking zone and camping ordinance, and with that they have a safe parking zone code of conduct. I also found reference to, sorry, I have a lot of notes on this.
No, good.
Like Washington has a safe parking program from 2020. And it appears that that has only applied to one church, the United Methodist Church. But also, you know, without kind of digging through every city's code, I'm not entirely sure if that represents.
No, that
portion or all of the cities that have.
That's helpful because that gives me an opportunity to see if there's any cases of first impression that, you know, because I'm sure that they've dealt with some of the issues that we are raising as far as concerns, and so I'd be curious to know exactly how those transpired. So thank you. No, that's helpful. Any other comments or questions for council? Commissioner Fernet?
Too many questions.
There's your opportunity.
Well, I don't know what safe parking means. Like in Anacortes on, what avenue is that? Not our S Avenue, T Avenue. They've got people parked all along there all the time in these run-down motorhomes, where you want to call them. They're not even street legal, I don't think. And I know people with businesses around there, and they have to lock their water up because their water bills went through the roof because everyone was taking water in the middle of the night. And their businesses are broken into constantly. Now, this is this. But you can't help but think, your mind wanders when you're reading this stuff. And you're saying to yourself, is this what we're inviting? And I don't know. So there's so many questions. I don't want what Anacortes has. Not for anybody in this city. But this might be entirely different. I just don't know.
Well, I think the argument that could be made, because I do share your concerns, is that this is us trying to get ahead of the curve on that, because you know, this is coming down the pike, and it's better to have some sort of structure than no structure.
Right, I agree.
So, you know,
but the enforcement.
Right.
It keeps coming back to enforcement. You could say, okay, clear out. That'll be the day. No. Okay, never mind. How is it going to come down to that? That's what I see. Anyway, I'm glad we're doing something. Just, we got to do it right. Mm-hmm. I don't want to invite it. You know, by doing this, are we saying, okay, everybody come to Cedar Woolley?
I think if you're, I mean, I agree that the flip side of the coin there is having some parameters and some rules to establish, you know, a baseline of safety. I think the bare minimum is anticipated by the statute that lays out what is possible for organizing ordinances around. So the restrictions about here, you have to have a certain amount of square footage. You have to have this many parking spots, have a fire extinguisher. There's at least a baseline. I don't think that it's a generous provision of services enough to draw people to be, and this is just complete speculation too, but I don't think this is a generous provision of services that would invite safe parking. I think this is just parameters that religious organizations must abide by if they're going to offer safe parking.
Yeah, I was warned by a person I know that lives 1,000 feet from a homeless camp, and he sees what happens when things get out of hand. And he said, for instance, they stopped enforcing the drug part of the rules, and next thing you knew, the septic, the Sanican outfit stopped picking up the Sanicans because they were full of needles and no one was stopping it. And so therefore it just started going downhill from there rapidly. So the key, he said, was you got to set up the rules and keep the rules. Someone's got to police it. So that's all I'm going to say. To get out of hand. So as long as we're there to watch it, someone's there to police it, and we mean it, it's got some teeth like your terminology, then I guess that's what we do.
I now have a question here. Go ahead. So you got me thinking, because you know, when we were presenting this, I mean, I suppose it was in the back of my mind that people might be coming from other communities, but I also assumed that it was probably to serve our local community. And I'm wondering, is there a mechanism or something that we can put into this ordinance that says that it's primarily for supporting our own community? I mean, we have a lot of homeless people here in Cedar Woolley, so we wouldn't have to go outside to find people to fill it, any of these things probably. But is there a way to limit it so we aren't being flooded by encampments of people who are not even from here, have no connection to here. They're just looking for a place to land. Tar, do you have any, is there any way to limit that or put that in the ordinance, or is that forbidden by the states?
Probably not. You probably have a dormant commerce clause issue with that. So I would, my recommendation would be to stay silent as to the people who are serviced by these encampments.
So you don't think it's a good thing to put that in the ordinance?
If you're concerned at all about enforcement, that would be terribly complicated to enforce.
Yeah, that
was kind of my
right. No, my I understand that too. Going in that. Yeah, who's a resident? Is it when you don't have a home anymore, you're not a resident? How do you define? Yeah, and I get it, but I'm thinking of what Mr. Frenette said, that I don't want to, by passing this ordinance to get in front of the state, say, we're open for business. Cedar Woolley is open for homeless encampments. You know, come on in. You know, we have our own people in our own community who need our services. So anyway, I feel that we shouldn't be setting it up. And I suspect it's just whatever community is the easiest and has the least rules is probably the one that gets swamped. Unfortunately, that's my take on it. And I also had a question. I didn't get your name, sir.
No.
Could you give me just a little more background on what you're saying? You brought up a really interesting point about there's going to be more people who are just giving up homes and living more of a nomadic lifestyle.
There's a lot of people going nomadic lifestyle. People don't want to be paying these high prices for houses and the property taxes and city amenities. And they're going, well, I can just get a trailer, a camper, whatever, and don't pay anything anymore. And they go move spot. And just live real cheap. And they're doing that everywhere in this country right now.
Right.
And an RV park, which is right down the street on Cook Road.
Yeah.
Is that a homeless encampment?
Yeah, basically. Yeah.
It is. If you're saying that is.
Well, I don't know that it is, but I noticed that it was, from the time the pandemic started, it was basically every slot full every day, which made me think that they probably have been long-term leasing their spaces to people. But anyway, I was just curious about that. And so the people you see that might be choosing this lifestyle, so that they're not willing to pay for spaces. They just want to come to a town and expect that in that town, there's going to be a safe parking place so they can park for a limited number of times.
Your stores and everything else.
Yeah.
Most of them aren't problems. There are some that are, but people are living in cars. And I see it, I go to abandoned vehicle auctions. There's a whole line of cars people were living in. They got in trouble with the police. Now they're in jail. And when they get out, their cars, all their belongings are gone. Now they're just in the street. You just keep making, digging them a hole. You know, they could be trying to get out. Not all of them, but they could be trying to get out and have a car to live in, and get to work. Well, that's gone. They lose their jobs. So many different aspects of homelessness. And you're just bunching it up. And it needs to be expanded to different categories.
Right. Yeah, I think what we're trying to do is set basic limits on safety and health standards so that whatever happens, the community is protected and those people are protected from the things. But anyway, thank you for giving me a little more information.
Thank you for letting me talk again.
Yep, that's all I have for the moment.
You have any additional comments or questions?
I don't know. I think that all these concerns are well taken. I would just remind the commission that this particular statute applies specifically to religious organizations who want to open up their property for temporary homeless encampments. And so it has nothing to do with campers parked along the street. It has nothing to do with homeless camps in the woods or any other, sort of iteration of homelessness. And I do believe that having formal encampments like this that are run by a religious organization offers maybe the best bet for getting people the services that were brought up earlier, whether that be mental health or substance abuse or just basic social work to help get housing or, any other services that are needed. And so I think that this statute goes a long way to address it. There's no sort of easy answers to this topic. And I believe that we're not going to, there's not a lot we can do. I mean, at this point, the city has no ability to enforce anything. If a religious organization wants to open a temporary homeless encampment, they can do so without any of these rules right now. And so I think we'd be well served to enact this or, you know, move this forward. And if situations arise that make it apparent that we need to tweak it a little bit in the future, we go down that road. So that's, I guess that's probably good for me.
Thank you. Really appreciate that. If there's no further comments or questions, I do want to thank everybody because this is a very heavy topic and a very current and contemporary topic that needs to be addressed, not just here in Sioux Valley, but everywhere, the issue of homelessness. And so I thank you all for your thoughts on that matter. And points all well taken. Thank you. And thank you, Tara, for answering our questions, even when we're grilling you there. Appreciate it. So at this point, I believe that that staff is looking for a recommendation, a possible support or disapproval of the ordinance. So is there anybody that is willing to make a motion to recommend or not recommend this to the city council?
I'd just like to say, if the Planning Commission is getting close to making a recommendation, I wanted to point out a couple of amendments that you were kicking around that you may want to consider while you're making a recommendation, however that may go. So one was to amend 17.110.020E to say this clause does not require the city to process and issue a permit within 30 days. Just that little disclaimer that we spoke about earlier. There was a lot of serious discussion about the concern of the lack of enforcement discussion on this chapter. And if you wanted to recommend, for example, recommend approval with clarified language about enforcement under Chapter 8, but is how will enforcement be handled under Chapter 18 or the Criminal Code? Any change like that would definitely require another public hearing. So we can do that at the city council level. It does complicate the process to add something like that without specific language that you had the chance to review and for the public to review. So that does complicate things if you so chose to go in that direction. But the easy one, I did want to point out also the first one, that 17.10.020E. To say this clause does not require a city process and issue a permit. Those are the two issues that came up that seemed like were likely areas for you to possibly have some comments.
I'm sorry, will there be a meeting in December? Traditionally, we do. Tabling 1 month is one thing, but tabling it for 3 more months.
Hey, Tara, can you clarify something for us?
Sure.
So, under 17.110.020E, where it mentions application for temporary homeless permit must be filed at least 30 days prior to the date. Do we need to specify whether or not that's calendar days or business days?
Yes. And we've said calendar days consistently, so I would recommend calendar days.
So it would be at least 30 calendar days before the date on which temporary, etc.
Unless you would like it to be business days, because that extends the timeline for the planning department.
I'm just unclear if that came out of statute, state statute, of whether it has to be 30 days.
I don't think that came out of the statute.
Staff doesn't have any preference.
And for the record, I would like to recognize that Commissioner Joe Patizzi has arrived at the meeting.
John, do you have a staff recommendation about the enforcement issue? I mean, ultimately, it's your office that's going to be making under 17-110-060, you're going to be making the decision about if a permit has to be revoked, at least in the initial stage. And so it seems like the issue that you brought up or that had been brought up was whether then that enforcement goes to code enforcement or whether it goes to some sort of criminal statute, which I don't have any opinion about legally or whatever. I don't know that. But do you have a preference about language in that regard, or is there, maybe Tara, you can comment on this, if the city has some sort of, you know, I don't know, maybe we need to research that, or.
I don't know offhand of our options moving forward. Maybe that's a better question for the planning department at this point, but I'm definitely able to research that and provide a better answer.
So on that note, just as a question for housekeeping and whatnot, so it has been raised by a commissioner, and I think it would be well taken to be considered. Is there any sort of hard deadlines regarding this, or is this something that we could further deliberate? I mean, it is a rather extensive code change and a important and also, you know, heavy topic as well. I don't know if it's the desire of the entire planning commission to possibly table this for the next planning commission meeting to make final deliberation, have opportunity for staff and council to do some research and then make a final recommendation to city council. I don't know if there's any background there that we aren't privy to.
Are you looking at me? Yeah. Looking at you, John. I was looking up other code, city really planning permitting code under the zoning code to see where enforcement matters might be.
Well, while you're doing that to allow you some additional time, and since Commissioner Patizzi has come right at the tail end of commission's deliberations and comments, I wanted to open it up for you to have an opportunity, if you desire, to share any thoughts or comments.
He hasn't been here for the public comments, and it would be a little inappropriate for him to begin. Tara, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think without having the same information that the rest of the planning commission has, it might not be real appropriate for him to weigh in on this topic today.
I'm fine with that, by the way.
Okay. Yes, you were not here. You were not present for the public meeting, so there's. You can't opine about the public meeting.
Well, I will hold my thoughts to myself until you read the minutes.
All
John, is there an urgency to move this forward, this meeting?
Only in that it's an important topic.
Okay.
There's not anybody that's been pressing the city that I'm aware of for a final action on this. So I don't have a good answer for you, but it is an important topic.
So,
and I'm not finding anything in our zoning code that is like typical as far as enforcement. Some chapters don't, like this chapter, doesn't say, talk about what happens for enforcement matters. That typically goes then to the code enforcement chapter. Which is chapter 18, or title 18 of the municipal code, which is more of a, no, that's not the criminal code section. So I don't have real strong answers on where enforcement with, it appears that this would land in code enforcement because it's under chapter 17, title 17. And I don't know if Tara can help me out on that one or not.
Sure. So the chapter 17.80, entitled enforcement, the penalties are laid out and you go to procedure. There are civil fines that are laid out in title 18.35. I am sorry, I don't know what a type 2 permit does or doesn't do, but I was assuming that a type 2 permit, if you violate it, would then abide by this assessment schedule in chapter 18.
Yeah. Okay, so what Tara's saying, and now I see it, is because this proposed title 17.110 is within title 17, which is our zoning chapter, then 17.80 applies, which says any person violating or failing to comply with any of the provisions contained in Title 17 shall be subject to the enforcement provisions contained in Title 18, which is the code enforcement chapter. So then you follow the path down the code enforcement chapter title, which has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, roughly 10 separate chapters within it that address the process for code enforcement. So notices of infraction, stop work orders, civil fines, abatement, liens, unfit dwellings, and structures. So the process is laid out in chapter 18. So that's how, if someone violates anything in the zoning code, we go through the chapter 18 is the process that tells us how we now enforce on that non-compliance. So any non-compliance of this proposed chapter would fall under title 18. So thank you for finding that and clarifying that for us, Tara. That is the answer to the enforcement question. It is title 18.
One half of the enforcement question.
I think we could also add something like a termination. Other cities have had language indicating that if the resident violates the terms and conditions of the permit, it results in immediate termination of the permit. If the city learns about violence or the host has not adequately addressed the situation, then the temporary use permit may be immediately terminated. So there could be something inserted to that effect, to your point as well.
So personally, I would like to see something like that. I mean, the enforcement provision, which I've lost it now, says that, you know, the planning director can revoke the permit, and then the revocation has stayed all the way through the appeal process. And it seems to me that that appeal process could well outlast the 180-day length of the permit to begin with, you know. And so if on day two there's some sort of egregious violation of the terms, it seems to me that the way this is written, that this thing could continue on as long as they, you know, kept the appeal process going for the full 180 days. And so, if, you know, Tara, I appreciated that language you shared that was a little bit stronger and made for, you know, an immediate revocation of the permit. And maybe then it could be reinstated upon a successful appeal or something like that, or you know, if the city was given clear indication that the criteria were reinstated, or you know, whatever it was, but
yeah, that the issue was cured. Or,
yeah. And so I certainly would feel more comfortable with language to that effect than what's currently there.
I would agree. Mm-hmm. So is it the desire of the Planning Commission to continue to deliberate this, to table any sort of motion, even though there hasn't been one, but to continue discussing and delivering the topic at the next Planning Commission to allow for either further personal research or deliberation, and or to allow staff to and council to do even further digging if necessary on any particular topics?
I think this is a real big deal. So taking a little time out based upon what was heard today to revisit it the next time and get a little bit more feedback on it. Just a general statement, right? I mean,
I'll be honest. This I don't even know how long I've been on the Planning Commission now, but this is probably the most difficult decision I've had to make on the Planning Commission. We deal with zoning stuff all the time in our comprehensive plan. We do all kinds of stuff, but here we're playing with the lives of people who are in more unfortunate situations than many of us, and also it's impacting people who have money and their time and their lives invested in properties. And so I definitely need another month to basically soul search my answer to this, because this affects this community from top to bottom. I agree with Silas that that, you know, with like all ordinances, we're going to put whatever we do here, we're probably going to put it in place, and we will learn as we go. And we hope that we covered 95% of the issues up front. But we just want to make sure we're not making a mistake here. So I would appreciate an extra month if we can.
You correct me if I'm wrong, but have we traditionally met in December? I feel like we have and we haven't at times.
I don't recall ever canceling in December.
We did last year, but in general, sure. I agree, we've done it most years.
Pretty sure we have in the past, but I can't remember what the rule was.
And we already have agenda items for next month.
So the chair is willing to entertain any sort of motion, whether it's to table it for a further month or whether it's to proceed with a recommendation or non-recommendation.
I'd like to move the table it for a month.
I'll second that.
All right, so it's been moved by Commissioner Frenette and seconded by Commissioner Huggins to table the topic for a future meeting. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Motion carries. All right, so that takes us to unfinished business. Since the chair of the planning commission has arrived. Are you wanting to take over or do you want me to present?
No, continue on.
Okay. Well, fine, I won't be able to chair. moving on to unfinished business. I requested amendments to the accessory dwelling unit ADU regulations of chapter 17.100 Seadrill Municipal Code to address ADUs for spec-built homes. And John, are you going to lead us into this topic?
Yeah. Okay, so it's been a couple of months, so I'll give a very brief rundown of this. Can I see a show of hands from planning commission members who did not, were not in attendance at the meeting where we discussed this last? Or has every planning commissioner already seen this at a meeting? Oh, great. Well, so there's not a lot for me to explain then. We received a request to update our accessory dwelling unit regulations to allow for spec-built homes to be built with ADUs. If you recall, the way our code is written right now, the language is that the homeowner must live on site, and because to issue a permit, the permit is issued to the homeowner to assure that the homeowner lives on site, and that homeowner must sign an affidavit saying they're going to live on site. That created a situation where, in the case of a spec-built home, which is built by a builder who's not intending to live in that home, but intends to sell it to a homeowner, the whole business model of building a home on speculation that somebody's going to buy it, that builder obviously can't sign an affidavit saying that they're going to live on site. So therefore, we can't issue an ADU permit to a spec builder. It creates a whole situation of now ADUs can't be built with spec homes. So the request was to put language into the ADU ordinance, the ADU code, to allow spec-built homes under certain conditions. Basically certifying that when the new homeowner will have to state that they're going to live on site. So the request was to put language like that in the code so that spec homes, really the intent is for spec homes to be able to be built with ADUs. We had a previous meeting on this and pointed out some of the pros and cons of it. The Planning Commission wanted to hear from the applicant, some people that might want to use such a code. So today we have the applicant here, and there's also somebody else here who's a builder and apparently is interested in the topic also. So unless the Planning Commission would like to hear anything more from staff, I'd like to turn it over to Paul Woodmansey, who is the president, CEO, owner of BYK Construction, and that is who requested this amendment.
Paul, you want to present? And thank you for your patience. I'm sure that was a long deliberation to get to where you want to speak. So.
Yeah, thank you guys. Had a great deliberation. I think you made the right choice. It's a tough topic. I don't envy your guys' position when it comes to discussing that. So, I do want to say thank you again. Just for the record, my name is Paul Woodmansey, owner and president of BYK Construction. Also an owner of Buckwood LLC, which is building out Buckwood Estates. Mix those names. We're also building Brickyard Park, and we just finished up Garden Meadows here in Cedar Rolling. So tonight, I just wanted to, read some of my thoughts to you, and then you guys can ask me some questions if you have any, and have a discussion. So today, there are many barriers to homeownership for members of our community. In the past, it's been items like a lack of a down payment, or buyer's bad credit scores, or for me, the lack of past tax returns when I started my business.
Today's a cut. Today, it really comes down to two issues for people: a lack of inventory and the actual cost of housing. And no, I'm not here again to talk about the lack of inventory so you can take a big sigh of relief. Today, I want to talk about the cost of a single family home. Everybody's been watching what interest rates have been doing across our nation. They've been moving up extremely high over the last 6 months. Currently, they're at a 15 high at 7%. And this has all happened in the last 6 months. Basically, rates have doubled. This has added thousands or hundreds of dollars to buyers' monthly mortgage payments. And this increase in interest rates has been very difficult for us as builders and buyers who want to buy our houses. We've experienced buyers completely walking away from the buying process altogether. They're deciding to rent and waiting for housing prices to drop or mortgage interest rates to drop. And we all know the advantages of ownership, and they've been broadcasted for decades, but the most important advantage is wealth building for homeowners. American home ownership is one of the widespread methods of creating wealth for the American people. Mortgage rate increases have shut down construction activity. BYK took a breather this year, basically didn't even start a house from May until this month, so 6 months. We just couldn't afford to continue to build houses when people weren't buying them, and people weren't even showing up to walk through projects. And that's a significant change from what has happened in the last few years. And this isn't just a buyer problem. This is a builder problem too, right? That we get to deal with. So we don't have the option of just not building forever. We have jobs finished. We have people that are employed, that have jobs with us. We have houses to build. So what we have to do is adjust what we build to make sure it meets the buying opportunity, what people can afford and what they need. So we felt like a great way for us to break this cost barrier for our buyers was to build something like an ADU with a home that would provide additional income for our buyers. The purpose and intent of the chapter of your ADU code says one intent is to provide homeowners with the means of obtaining through tenants in either accessory dwelling unit or the principal residence, rental income, companionship, and or security. If we were able to, as builders, build these ADUs for our clients in our new construction spec homes that we sell, the ADU would provide all three of those intents to your senior woolly neighbors. With an ADU, the buyer gets rental income that assists them in breaking the barrier of the cost of housing. When a buyer submits for a mortgage, their income is reviewed. They are told what they can afford for a sales price based off their income. When a lender can factor in an extra $600 to $1,200 a month of income for an ADU on a piece of property, it increases the purchasing power for that buyer tremendously. The buyer's income from their hard work, as well as the future rents they would receive, are both calculated in their income. With an ADU, the buyer can also have companionship and security. There's a lot of people out there who would love to have their parents live in an ADU behind them, or people who have adult children who need their own space, don't have a space to live, or people that just want friends to live on their property in the ADU. All three of these tenant options provide people with the companionship and security that the ADU code discusses. Lastly, the last thing I'd like to point out and bring up is that when professional home builders construct new communities, we're able to design the homes and the ADUs to complement each other instead of conflicting with each other, like in older neighborhoods. If ADUs were only allowed to be built by current homeowners on historic lots, the external and fundamental factors of layout and design can be often very difficult to design appropriately, and this causes frustration for neighbors nearby. When we design and build ADUs in a new neighborhood that we are selling on spec, our buyers know that the ADU is a potential in our new neighborhood that they're buying before they ever make an offer. So you could never have a neighbor complain to the city about an ADU being constructed. They knowingly are buying in that neighborhood. Also, when an ADU is constructed by us, it's built to meet the actual design criteria that the city's put in place without having to make variations to the code to make something like an existing house match with an ADU. So it's basically, it's the opposite of putting a square peg through a round hole. It's putting a square peg through an appropriately sized square peg hole. the current ADU code is completely restrictive for builders to build ADU buildings for spec home construction. With simple addition of language that the builder of a spec home and ADU must acknowledge the requirement of the covenant that the owner must live on the property and have this covenant completed and executed when we do the closing process with the title company, we can break down the current barrier of housing costs for neighbors and community members. So thank you for your time.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you.
Is there any questions that anybody wants to ask of Paul while we have him at the podium?
I think this is a typo on the attachments. We have attachment one required request from the BYK Construction to amend the existing ADU regulations in the urban village mixed commercial use overlay.
That's correct.
That's not right. But it's definitely a typo because you're not requesting a change to the UVMU. Pick it up. I don't have any questions myself.
I have a question. And this might, I don't know if you have any comment on this, Paul, but John may also. What happens when you, as a spec builder, build a house that has an ADU and there's this covenant requirement for owner occupancy and somebody doesn't want that? Like somebody might be buying this home or maybe they live in it for 2 years and then they want to move out and rent it out or whatever, and that ADU goes into violation. Maybe John, this is your department. What happens to that ADU? Is it just like no man's land then? Like it can't be rented out separately from the main structure, or like the whole place has to be rented to one person and they can utilize it as they see fit?
Really good question. Presumably, if they just, you know, say someone bought the house and they're like, we don't want to use it in an ADU. We've got, you know, grandma living with us.
Sure.
What's the difference if it's grandma living in there or it's, you know, rented out to somebody else? Like, if it's a family member, I guess, you know, kind of like, well, you know, I guess it's just part of your house. You don't need to sign the ADU stuff. But yeah, enforcing ADU regulations is extremely challenging because we don't typically go knocking on doors saying, hey, you know, who's living in here?
Sure.
Now we do have the requirement that they sign something stating that they're following the rules. So if they've signed that, then they're allowed to have an ADU and they're following the rules.
Sure.
We don't track when houses sell, though, necessarily. And these are all things that we discussed during the ADU discussion to begin with. So we don't necessarily track when houses sell, but, you know, if we catch wind of one, I guess I need to send them a letter saying, hey, you need to get right with the zoning ordinance or your or enforcement under Title 18 will begin.
Most likely what would happen is you're going to have a neighbor complain.
Sure.
And they're going to say, hey, John, this person moved out. And
they're renting two separate.
Paul admits he bought the house back and is renting it to two people.
Right? The party in the
back. I mean, not that I would do that. But, you know, anybody who buys the house from somebody else, they have to follow the title. The company will have this on title. Brought up. It'll be brought up through the real estate process, right? So
yeah.
Whoever buys that is going to know the rules. And we all know that there's people that break the rules all the time.
Sure. No doubt about it. For the record, I am for this allowance for spec built ADUs. I think it's a great idea. I don't have any, as long as they comply with our existing ADU ordinance, I have no qualms with it. And as the Planning Commission well knows, I am opposed to the owner occupancy requirement inherently. And so I am not, you know, this is just another example of where I find that requirement problematic. And so anyway, I'm going to have to leave here in like a couple minutes because I got a child care, a babysitter that needs to be relieved. So I don't know if we're going to take action on this tonight or.
Well, there's no actual code presented here. Today was an attempt to get total feedback so we could write something specific, an amendment to the code, if the Planning Commission's even interested in seeing, going to make a recommendation. But I need to actually massage what BYK put together for us to, you know, fit into code and bring that for you to review as an actual code change. And with all code changes required, a public hearing. So we need to have a public hearing.
We've got actual ways to go.
So nothing today.
Okay.
So feel free to leave.
I'm going to leave. 8:15 is kind of my cutoff, so I'm going to take off. But thank you, Paul. And you all know my stand on this, so carry on.
Thank you, Seth.
Thanks,
Any other questions that anybody wants to pose of Paul Woodmancy here?
Just a small one. I agree. This sounds great. I'm surprised we didn't think of it when we were doing this originally, but I think I was thinking large lots, established house with a huge backyard, plenty of room for an ADU or a two-car garage or what, you know, rec room over garage. Big houses, big lots. That's how I envisioned it. But nowadays, you know, you got to squeeze 4 to 5 houses into an R5 per, you know, per acre. The lots are getting smaller.
Sure.
So are these going to be attached, do you think, in your mind? Can you walk me through what you envision?
Yeah, so at our Bucko Estates property right now, our lots are on the larger size. They're 7,000, 6,000, 6,500, 7,000 square feet, so, which are bigger lots for sure. We're currently designing plans right now for that project, and so we're kind of designing them to fit an ADU.
Detached or
attached? Detached, mostly, yeah. We like the idea of the house, you know, kind of front, tucked up front to create a large backyard, and then the ADU off to one side all the way in the back that creates additional parking for the ADU and for the house. These parking is always a problem, but it also kind of creates a private backyard area. So most of the designs we've come up with so far are that kind of strategy. We haven't gotten to the point where we think that a like house with an attached garage with an ADU above it. I don't think that's what our buyers would want. I think they'd want more of a separated solution. So
now that I think about it, I used to be part of a municipality where just about everybody had an ADU in the basement.
Yeah.
They had 9-foot basements and every one of them had an outside entry. Yeah. And almost all of them were rented out.
Yeah, there's definitely, that's when you have that kind of vertical separation too. I think that's something that people would really like, especially if they're alley loaded lots and the basement could be loaded from behind and the house is loaded from up above or something like that for a daylight basement scenario. But on Bucko Estates, which is what we're imagining this going in, we have flat lots in the sand, you know, we're not going to.
If you built 10 houses there, would all 10 have the ADU?
No, not just specifically.
Like 10%, maybe 20%?
Yeah, I mean, it's buyer driven, right? Yeah. So I'm going to start out, I'm going to build 4 to 6 houses. You know, I'll probably do 2 to 3 of them with an ADU, see what the market says. The market could say, Paul, you're crazy. I don't want this, you know, and I could never build one again. it's possible. So
in my pea brain, I thought if a person can't afford one house, how they're going to afford 2 houses?
Sure.
But And then it's expensive for you because now you're paying two of the impact fees, or one and a half.
No, I'm not sure exactly about that.
So you pay one and a half impact fees. So your prices are going up. And
absolutely.
The price to buy the place is going up. And then I tried to buy a rental house once where I wasn't going to live in it. And they wanted to, I can't remember the interest rate went way up. Oh, I know what it was. I had, instead of 20% down, I had 40%
down.
None
of them are occupied.
It may not pan out, but I agree with what you're trying to do.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt there's a risk to it for us. You know, we're making some market assumptions. And, you know, if rates dropped down to 3% again in 6 months, then the strategy could be different. People could say, hey, I would rather not have an ADU. Right. So I'd rather, you love pre-sales and stuff there. People come and say, no, I don't want to build an ADU. I can afford this on my own. No problem. You know, we're just trying to put all the tools in our toolbox we can to make sure that we're continuing to build and continuing to build things that people can buy instead of us having to rent houses. Because I like rental homes. I like owning them. I like owning apartments. You all know that. But on the flip side of it, I love selling houses to people and have them brag about their house to their friends. You know, I love that side of what we do. And I love that people have pride in buying a BYK, you know. And so it's a big deal to me to be able to sell homes and sell things that people want to live in. And that I can create jobs for people and make a profit at the same time. You know, all those are good things.
Good. I agree. Thanks.
So I think it might be a good idea to put some bounds on this. We're saying that this would be specific to spec homes, so maybe put a definition for what a spec home exactly is. Other people might not. And then secondly, I'm envisioning this, you say new developments, I'm envisioning this long paths, things like that, but what want to put some bounds.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Ruby and I were talking about that actually. Ruby Davis, a friend of mine, also a builder. And, you know, would we limit it to what's a new development, I guess, right? That's what the question is. Is it a single family home on one lot where a house burned down and now somebody buys it and wants to, you know, like me buys it and wants to build a house in an ADU? So I think that's a conversation you all should have. You might want to limit it to a short plat of four houses and above or something.
That's a good call.
Why would that matter though in an example like that house burning down? Because it's in the code anyway.
Yeah.
It's already there, and that's always been my point. That's why I don't have a problem with exactly what you're proposing. It's already there.
Yeah.
And it doesn't make sense to do it up front, just from a design guideline standpoint.
Absolutely.
So I didn't have a problem. But why would we even think about something like that? I mean, it would be the option on who's gonna buy the property, but if it's a somebody building a single family house, they're probably doing it for themselves. And that whole example of kids, parents, all that stuff, that's all legitimate stuff. And we beat that to death when we did that code, because that's pretty much what it's going to be for. Back to the other reasoning as well, that does get included into the income calculation. So from a lender standpoint, yeah, it could be the difference of getting that higher loan amount simply for the fact that you know you have an established baseline of, let's say, $1,400 a month or whatever it comes out to be, that gets thrown into the calculation. So
I have to agree, if it was up to me, everyone would be done this way.
Yeah, I mean, if I was sitting on the commission, I'd say, you know, I wouldn't limit it at all, because, you know, I don't think it's ever a bad thing to have a professional builder come in, build something that's going to work well, just be designed well, meet the criteria that you know, want to see in these developments, and then be turning around and sell to somebody. So I wouldn't limit it at all, but it is something that, you know, like, brought up.
In the back of my mind, I'm thinking, though, that makes an R5 and R10 or something, like, you know, math is off here. But
sure.
In other words, you're almost doubling the population of an area that shouldn't be.
Yeah, I mean, but it's not going to happen on every lot, you know, but, yeah. You know, you're right. It does double a population. The other reality of these spaces is somebody might buy it right now because they need the income, and they 5 years from now are making more income, and they boot that person out and they use it for their at-home office.
Yeah.
You know, like, that's going to happen. there's a lot of remote work now. There's a lot of people doing that, you know, having that private space away from the kids and the family in the summertime for whoever's a, you know, breadwinner of the family. I mean, that's going to be something that will happen, you know. So, and the spaces don't always, you know, it could be just a, hey, our 18-year-old son now is, or 17-year-old son now is moving here because we want to split up Tommy and Joey from the one bedroom they share. You know, I mean, that stuff's going to happen too. So it's housing options and throughout our community, it's extremely important, you know. And we've had those conversations in the past, and you guys know that. And this is just another tool in the tool chest that we have as a community to create more housing options. And, you know,
so. One concern I have is that every builder is not as conscientious as you are, and because I'm not going to name names, but we've had builders who built really schlocky stuff in town, and it wouldn't have been better to have them do the plan than an individual homeowner buying the thing or pre-sailing the, or having you pre-sale the home to them where they saw the plans and then you built it for them. And so that's one concern I have, and then the other is what Joe said down there about upzoning. It's
yeah.
And I understand why you would do that, because if we upzoned, if we said now we're R14 instead of R7, or R10 instead of R5, then the values of the property go up and you lose the savings for the person who's trying to buy the home. So that's the conundrum I'm in on this one. Help me out of it.
So the first problem was the other builders that don't have the same respect to the community, I guess I'd call it. You know, that's there no matter what. So you're going to have builders that don't do as good a job. The good news with ADUs and this whole process and every plat is that there's a building permit process, right? And sure, John's not able to tell everybody to put this what siding product and he can't tell them how to design the house, but there are certain criteria you have that they have to meet that are the minimums, right? And I guess your building department and planning department are your watchdogs for that. And I would love to be the only builder in town, but it's not the reality. So I think that that's just something that to say, hey, I want to hinder the good guys because the bad guys might do the same thing, you know, I think is a progressive stance, I guess I would say.
Yeah.
So, the second problem was kind of upzoning. I think it's a problem for neighborhoods that are older neighborhoods, historic neighborhoods that, you know, hey, I've lived here for 30 years and we've never had ADUs everywhere through here. When you have a brand new neighborhood though, you know,
yeah, people don't know what they could have. They know what's there. And
yeah, exactly. And so, but when they buy into a new neighborhood, you know, it's they're buying into what that neighborhood is. And you know, when our 55 plus buyers that's at Brickyard Park come in, you know, they buy in because that's a 55 plus neighborhood. You know, and this neighborhood would be one that's potentially has what some people see as a detriment as being an upzone neighborhood, right? If those people don't want to buy in that neighborhood, they don't like that, they're just not going to buy there. And I'm taking the risk building that up front, saying, hey, I think the majority of people are going to want this.
And again, I'm not speaking to your project specific. I'm just saying like, that my feeling is that a lot of people end up buying into neighborhoods just because they're going to get in at whatever neighborhood they can get into. And then they'll later, when they get making more money, they'll build their dream home or they'll move to the neighborhood they want.
Yeah.
And so, so I kind of get your argument, but on the other hand, I feel like sometimes people just get, they got to get in to get in. It's like you said, it's the best way to build equity and wealth, and you just got to get in the game. And so I would be curious to know how many people just get into whatever they can get into and then move up. So,
you know, I mean, just speak frankly, a lot of my buyers, you know, it's houses costs have been very high for a long time. So people buying are deliberate. They're buying for because they want a nice home. They're spending a lot of money on that home already, right? It doesn't feel, in what I do, it doesn't feel like this is my home for my next home. Most of my buyers have been, yeah, that's a dream of mine in the future, but I'm buying this home because this worked for my family. This is where I want to live. So I haven't seen a lot of, I've been doing this for 14 years now too. And I've had two repeat clients in 14 years. So, you know, I think that most people, once they get in there and you're able to secure your housing cost at 10 years ago price, it's a big deal to change after that, right? Even all the equity you could take from that house and put in the next one, you might have the same freaking payment when you get 7% interest over 3.5%. Yeah, right. So, you know, it's I don't see that happening that much, honestly. So I do see a bigger issue this next year for us, next couple of years for us, with how fast costs will come down.
They're not, never going to come down all the way.
They won't. You're absolutely it's, right. It's always so the problem is you'll have people wait, and they'll wait and they'll wait. Prices won't come down, and they'll lose 5 years of paying off that mortgage. Right. So I'm looking at trying to get options now for people to buy now that might not be exactly what they want, but it works for them. Right. And so that's why I'm proposing what we're trying to do.
Okay. Last question is just for your lot sizes in the place where you're doing this, the lot with the ADU and without the ADU, it's the same size lot or within a little bit. So you're not like downsizing the lot sizes because they're not going to have an ADU.
Absolutely not. Okay. No. The lot sizes are predetermined at a preliminary plat stage. And then once we go to construct them, they stay the same.
My other concern, and I think you've explained that enough to me that I know that's not what you're doing, but is that I wouldn't want to get in a situation where the builder put in all of the ADUs, and then people who move into the neighborhoods who later decide that they got to have a place for grandma to live or for their kids to live till they can save enough or whatever, have a place to. I don't want them to be cut out of the process, or what do they call it, precluded from doing.
No, I mean, the ADU code is the ADU code, so they'll be able to build that no matter what. But I will tell you that we'll have some house plans that take up the whole width of the lot, where an ADU can't be built in the future, right? And then we'll with an ADU house and lot we plan, we'll actually build a more narrow home
in order to fit an easement,
exactly, in order to fit the ADU. So it actually should be a pretty nice looking community because you don't have to set back homes up front at the front of the building line. You'll actually have a home that's 50 foot wide, yeah. And the next house would be 30 feet wide with a 20 foot wide ADU behind it, right? Oh, okay. So there'll be a little bit of difference there.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much.
Two quick questions I have for you. By and large and in general, I do support this. I think it's a great idea. I think it makes a lot of sense. Something that I would like you to kind of talk me down from is, you know, as you made mention, and I was thinking about this as I was contemplating for this meeting, is so by increasing the buying power of, you know, these potential buyers of the homes with ADUs, are you actually kind of perpetuating, you know, you're keeping the housing prices high anyways. And so does it in its entirety actually solve that cost conundrum that tends to be the barrier for most people?
Does it get just baked in?
Or does it just get baked into the whole thing?
I get what you're saying. I guess it does prevent us from having a lower prices of homes in order to get sales. But what it does is, so you're right about that. It does do that. I'm not saying that when I build this ADU house, it's going to be cheaper because it won't.
No, it'll be I realize basically the
same price. Right. What I'm trying to do is make an all even price scheme in which I'm adding an income stream to that buyer in order for them to actually buy. I'll be frank and honest with you guys all. We just pulled four houses off the market in Garden Meadows in our old ages plat and last weekend and just put them up for rent. And I had 4 months in a row of open houses, not open houses every month, but 4 weekends in a row of open houses, 4 months in a row, in which I didn't even have one show in those homes. And those homes previously had all sold before they were even completed. So we're talking about not just a problem of house costs. We're talking about buyers just gone, right? So, it's for us to make the sales happen, we have to go to extreme measures. Then, historically, this wouldn't be something that you'd do. Most people want to buy their home. They want to live on it by themselves for the most part, And times have changed. There's no doubt about that. Mom and dad living with us, or an older son or daughter living with us, or, the cousin that, got kicked out of his house is living with us, whatever it is, those things are happening. And it does, boil down to some lack of availability in housing also, of why those problems exist.
Mm-hmm.
You're right. Will I sell a 1500 square foot home with a, 400 square foot ADU for the same price I was just trying to sell my 1800 square foot house at? Absolutely. But, in regards to my costs haven't started coming down. And for us to continue to build homes when we sell, although we've been lowering our sales price. So in that neighborhood, we had lowered our sales price and one time, and we had offered $12,000 buyer credits for paying the interest to buy interest rates down a whole 1%. And we got no movement. So we're in the process of lowering prices at Brickyard Park right now already, substantially, probably $20,000 to $40,000 across the board. So if my costs don't come down and match that, then I just don't keep building. I can't not keep building, right? So I have to come up with solutions on how to bridge that gap.
Okay. I appreciate the honesty on that too. A second question, which is related, but, slightly off topic. With the issue, something that was even way before pre-pandemic and before, the buzzword of, housing shortage was ever really a thing. It seemed like, especially in Skagit County, no one really lives by themselves. I feel like I'm kind of like an exception to the norm there, not to get too personal, but I don't believe that most people live by themselves. And so I'm wondering, from a developer's perspective, if we were to go from a one car off street requirement to a two, because if everybody on the planning commission knows that parking is always a hot topic for me, how does that impact you guys as far as like the ADU element of the code? Like,
is two on off street parking, mm-hmm, for the ADU?
Yeah, because I know that's always one of the big rubs with ADUs, right? When you're, especially if you're going to be moving into that, you know that you're coming into a certain situation. Well, ADU is always the big rub is, well, okay, now we're going to have a whole bunch of, parking issues, and then if they have friends over, then that just exacerbates it. And so, to kind of minimize that problem, and I would imagine make it more sellable, at least that's my layman's understanding, is by adding like an additional parking spot, would that be advantageous or would that be detrimental to?
I think it would be detrimental to people building ADUs. In my design, how I'm doing it, I would have two linear spots for an ADU, just because of how far back it's set along the driveway. John and I actually went over this pretty in-depthly with like a site plan. I was showing them what I was doing, but not when I was talking more about this. But you can't always have two parking spots, and I would actually kind of argue back a little bit that being an apartment owner, I actually have a lot of single people that live on their own and they have one car. And so, you know, to have another space for them, no matter what, would actually minimize the ability to create these units for people. So are there, and in the end, it's going to come down to the homeowner and their tenant and what they allow and what they don't allow. So I've been in the past pushing for parking code throughout city ruling, which I think is a topic you guys should cover someday. Because the city doesn't enforce parking code at all. But, you know, as when I approach it, you know, I approach it, we have parking passes at our apartment complex. You know, once a week we go through and we look at cars that don't have them, we tow them or we find out whose they were. And, you know, so it's about a tenant. What I'm getting at is it's a landlord-tenant issue that I think is solely in their discretion. And if they rent their ADU to two people that have two cars, then that owner needs to step up to the plate and say, here's your two parking spaces, right? And that means that they need to park in their garage. They need to have two cars in the garage. They'd have two cars in front of the garage. They could have two cars alongside the house. That'd be six total parking spot on one lot. So I don't think it's a good idea personally. If you wanted that to be tied to how many bedrooms there are, then that's something that could be, you know, if you have somebody who puts in a two bedroom ADU that meets a square footage requirement, it would make more sense to me to, you know, require two parking spots. The ones I'm looking at building are pretty small. They're meant for one person. Somebody renting it out to two people would be pushing the envelope. Right? So.
Sorry, I was just thinking that Cedar Woolley, in Cedar Woolley, the kind of it's a default that your front yard is the extra parking space. You know how many houses there are in town where they park? They just drive it in on the grass.
Just drive on the grass.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or Toyota pickup side by side.
Yeah.
Don't mock me. I got no place else to put it.
Just as far as everything that goes with this, you know, we are in a design phase for our project. We spend a lot of money on design. So knowing whether this is, you know, something that is going to be approved and moved forward is important to us. So, if it's not, if something you guys support, I would just ask that kindly that it doesn't get withheld back in terms of making some motions and moving forward eventually.
I think it's something we missed on the original draft. It just makes all the sense in the world to me. It's no different if you do it on the back end versus the front end, as long as the same stipulations are there regarding other occupancy. We got enough of teeth in that law. So, so I'm fine with it myself.
We're going to address it in the summer of 2000.
That'll be a little late.
You might see a bunch of houses pushed over to one side.
Any other comments or questions for Mr. Manson?
Yeah, just one. Sorry. How many homes do you do that are pre-sale? Is that in the equation, or does not many people do that anymore?
I would say probably 10% of our homes we build are pre-sale. Not that many.
So they look at a plan and they look at the lot and then
you can build it. We have you can go online, you can look at the lots that are available. Each one of our projects has a website that has a plat map, and you can click on the lot. It'll tell you what house will fit on that lot, and you can choose your house.
Okay. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you all.
Thank you, Paul.
Appreciate it.
Thank you, Ruby, for coming out and attending. With that concludes our unfinished business for the evening. Hopefully, staff has you guys have enough direction to.
So we're going to move forward. You'd like to see something.
I feel like the consensus is definitely moving forward. But
and we'll hopefully try to have a next month. It's going to be a crazy meeting.
We've got live work on next month's agenda. We've got what else? Breweries.
Breweries.
On next month's agenda. We now have a public hearing for homeless encampments on next month's agenda. So
it's a rocket docket.
And then this would have a public, this is ready for a public hearing then too.
All right.
So do we put four public hearings holy on cow. Next month's December 20th meeting?
Merry Christmas.
You know, we've done long meetings before. This isn't the first time. When we were doing
We only got through two today.
Yeah.
At
8:35.
Yeah.
Yeah,
but the
it's
first
quarter to nine.
I expected I wasn't
and no public there. Input. I mean, we had these gentlemen, but like on the homeless ordinance, I was expecting a room full today and saw nobody. So
well, there will be another public hearing, so there'll be another shot at it. So
I'm just saying, if they showed up, if 25 people showed up and wanted to talk, and we have four things on the docket.
Just so you know, we'll see if we can put four items on next month's docket. It's so, you know, a few days, 5 days before Christmas. Never know.
One right now, it's pretty much already written. It's just a fine.
So it's up to you if you want all four items on that agenda. Otherwise,
I'm fine with it myself.
Yeah, I think homeless ordinance probably isn't going
to
take a lot of time either.
By the mayor, see which ones we delay.
Could live work be delayed until January?
I don't think so.
Okay.
So
I'm just playing
our
marathon.
Our hot chocolate thermoses and a pillow and be ready to.
Tom and Jerry's.
See if the mayor can. Enter.
So anyway, well,
Spence found glass of coffee to get us through.
As a planning commission, I would anticipate not needing to be home by 15 or even 9 next meeting.
Sounds like we've gone after 9 punch topics.
Yeah. So just no, from this moment on, plan for a marathon next time.
Planning commission sit well.
We're going to have a lock-in.
A lock-in.
All right. And so there's no items of new business. Any items for the good of the order that anybody has? All right. Well, in that case, the chair will happily entertain a motion to adjourn.
I make a motion to adjourn.
I second.
It's been moved and seconded to adjourn. All those in favor?
Aye.
All those opposed? We are adjourned at 8:44 p.m. Good night, everybody.
Thanks. Thank